When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Screen Talk. I'm Eric Cohn.
I'm Ann Thompson.
And we've got plenty to discuss this week from some upcoming movies, the ones that are opening this weekend and festivals around the corner, strike speculation. It's a busy time. But first things first, and I'm stuck upstate with my in-laws because my daughter's daycare was closed, so I couldn't go to the All Media for the new Mission Impossible movie. So this is all you. I know like reviews are breaking in a little bit, but it seems like first impressions are starting to percolate anyway. So yay or nay, is Tom Cruise still kind of badass? At 60.
He is. It's like a comfortable old sweater, but it's incredibly well made. That's the thing. The thing that I was sort of struck by was Christopher McQuarrie's directorial excellence. You know, there's an incredible train sequence in Indiana Jones Dial of Destiny, right?
You know, right at the beginning.
There's a lot of train top stunts in that movie too. There's a whole series of train top stuff and inside the train and heading toward a big abyss. Christopher McQuarrie in this, you know, you know about the Tom Cruise takes the motorcycle off the cliff thing. That's been shown on social media
endlessly,
ad infinitum. So the audience was, you could hear a pin drop during that scene. It was like everybody held their breath. It was pretty great to be in the theater and watch that as it played out. But during this train sequence, which goes on and is just bravura, it's just fabulous. The audience applauded. This is the jaded media audience at the end.
That's funny. Well, no, it is interesting because it's like action filmmaking now is such a, like, it's all about showmanship. Everybody's trying to one-up each other. It's like, how long can you go without cutting when you're not really even doing a one, or you're doing CGI? So you want to continue to astonish people in different ways, or are there other, it sounds like these movies have kind of like staked a claim as like, yeah, action filmmaking is like cluttered with a lot of showmanship, but we're taking it to the next level because Tom Cruise will literally die to take it to that level.
The fact that you know that he did that stunt is pretty incredible when you watch it on a big screen and he goes off the end of it and you're going like, holy crap. But McQuarrie really had fun with the train sequence. He had a good time. And Hayley Atwell is good in it, you know, the new woman, and Rebecca Ferguson is back and the team is back. And so that's what I mean by the comfortable old sweater. It's very familiar. Virginia Kirby's back. It's very familiar, but it is fun. It's so fun. It's going to be huge. And I think it's amusing that Cruise is out there saying, hey, go to Oppenheimer, go to Barbie.
You know, please.
He's taking pictures of himself in front of posters of the competition because he doesn't want to own everything, or he just wants to be a team player, or he wants to support the box office per se without, because those movies aren't going to be as big.
Well, that's the end of the day. But it is funny because there was, of course, this early media or news cycle around Tom Cruise being pissed that Oppenheimer was taking over these IMAX screens for Mission Impossible. So
I don't think he particularly liked that narrative. Yeah. And so.
This is damage control on that front, but
they're all being very withholding about screening these movies. There's been a junket, at least there was some kind of Barbie thing, you know, and they're having some fun with marketing, with building a big house, you know, a pink house.
Yeah, the dream house.
But they're not giving up a lot of details. They're not giving us a lot of access to interviews yet or screenings. I mean, they're waiting until the last possible minute to
they're
show
just letting
these
the
movies.
Internet
they're afraid
have
of us.
Yeah, but
Eric,
the meme of Oppenheimer versus Barbie has been fun enough to follow. They don't even have to do anything. The internet's talking about these things, but they're tracking at, you know, Oppenheimer's tracking at 40 million.
That's right.
Barbie's tracking at 80. And these are not amazing numbers for summer tent poles of sorts.
So Oppenheimer, you know, we can assume is going to deliver. I just have to have confidence in Christopher Nolan that it will be a terrifying and riveting experience. It's a drama though, you know, so you know, and
yeah, but when he did Dunkirk, I remember people were like, huh, so he's just doing a war movie now. And it ended up being, you know, one of his best, and he got an Oscar nominated for it.
Yeah. Yes. I think these are movies that could grow, is my point.
Yeah.
But Barbie, in other words, I'm saying we know what Oppenheimer is. Barbie is a big question mark to me. I mean, it's like, I'm really excited. I want to see it. I have a lot of faith in Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie and everybody involved, but I need to see this thing. And they're not building up word of mouth via press screenings. They're not doing it that way.
I thought it was interesting that, I hate that word, but I was curious about the first and second Barbie trailers, right? Because the first Barbie trailer is pure Barbie land. And then the second one, suddenly you're getting more plot, which is a huge risk. Is it showing you, oh, Barbie goes into the real world? Is that a spoiler? Right. I guess if you watch the trailer. So you know that there's like sort of a gamble here. And we've seen Lego Movie. We've seen different kinds of ways in which these kind of like fantasy meets reality kind of stories have been done before. So is it something we've sort of seen? Is it not as groundbreaking or as exciting as people think? And what is the real audience for a Barbie movie? It seems to be for grownups. It's not a kids movie.
For grownups, and too. Are they aiming at women? Are they aiming at the women who had Barbie dolls? You know, what is the target audience for this movie?
Right.
Is my question.
It's certainly those of us who like Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach. So that helps. I don't know how many people.
I don't think
gets
that's
on a
wide audience. So is this a rom-com? Is this a rom-com? You know, what is it? I mean, Ryan Gosling looks hilarious to me as Ken. You know, so I'm in, but I just say this is not a guarantee commercial movie until I've seen it. I need to see it.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's and of course we were going to talk about this later in the podcast, but if the actors strike, right, then movies like this are in real trouble because they haven't been doing a ton of promotion leading up to the release, and then suddenly maybe the actors are not available to do it later.
One of the explanations for why some of the box office has been down, and we could segue to that, is, I mean, it's nice that Asteroid City and Past Lives are doing as well as they are. It's fantastic, in fact. And Asteroid City is blowing past Budapest Hotel. It's blowing past Everything Everywhere All at Once. I mean, it's really doing that well. So that is a relief to everyone. But I suspect that both Asteroid City and Past Lives, one of the reasons they're doing so well is that they're playing young. It's still the older audience that may be AWOL, you know? It doesn't prove that the older audience has come back yet.
Well,
and No Hard
Asteroid
Feelings
City
even opened well.
Yes, I thought that
Lawrence.
Was actually, and we were surprised by that. I mean, it was something that...
Well, it did, you know, better than the tracking was suggesting.
Well, with our conversation with Tom Rothman last week, I was thinking about it. It's like, if we did this next week after this movie opens, would our conversation be impacted by it? But actually, you know, it didn't, you know, necessarily show that the R-rated comedy is still a hugely profitable endeavor. And there were a lot of questions about it, but it did decent. So there's an appetite for edgy.
And it suggested that Jennifer Lawrence has some star power, which is a good thing, which is we want to know that.
So there are a handful of stars at work, and there's a younger audience, but the older audience on both the macro level of blockbusters and on the art house level is still fairly elusive.
And then the DC thing is interesting. All right, so if we look at The Flash, which bombed, and it really collapsed.
I don't want to look at it ever again, actually. But
second weekend, 72%. That's a big dive. For
the world has moved on.
Opened, what weekly? You know, it opened badly. It suggests that the word got out. This was a, you know, they could wait. They could wait for a better superhero movie. And I still think it was dumb of Warner Brothers to overhype it and to not wait to see how it did before they say, hey, that wasn't our movie. That was their movie.
Right.
That was the prior administration that made that. But
yeah, James Gunn getting behind it.
They gave it their best. And Spider-Verse is doing great still. and Elemental, which is disappointing on some level, held well though, and so did Little Mermaid. They're sort of chugging along. They're disappointing, but they're not collapsing. They're doing well.
Well, that's what you're seeing. I would think is on some level like this underserved family market, so right. Those movies can hang out throughout the summer as families need stuff to go see. So that certainly works in their favor, even though they didn't open as well as they should. I'm really curious.
The box office is way down.
Yeah. So Indiana Jones finally comes out this week, and that's tracking at $65 million. You know, for a movie that was made for $300 million.
It's one of the most expensive movies ever made. It is,
which is ridiculous.
A lot of it had to do with the development costs and the pandemic costs. And, you know, they had to switch from India to some other location at the last minute.
It's not like Avatar, though. It's not like when you see it, you see all those dollars up on screen.
No, you don't. You don't. It's a beautifully made movie, and I'm a fan of it. And I did talk to James Mangold, which was a lot of fun because he's one of the smarter directors out there. And it was fascinating to me to find out why he wanted to take that risk of following in Spielberg's footsteps, which is such a dicey thing to set yourself up for.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm so curious to see. I mean, I was watching TV last night and the ad came up, and I was wondering, like, are people excited about the, you know, like the 80-year-old Indiana Jones hanging his hat up for the last, these like end narratives aren't always as gratifying to people as you might think. You know,
it worked with the Star Wars, but then you had a whole younger generation taking off. I mean, I responded to Han Solo and Princess Leia, you know, as adults, as grownups.
Well, see, that's an interesting argument. This idea that maybe the Indiana Jones is that movie for older audiences more than Oppenheimer or something like that, because you have, you know, it's a 40-year-old franchise. So,
well, we all grew up with it at some point or another. And I've been there since Raiders of the Lost Ark, when I first saw the movie. But how that's another one. It's like, is this the Indiana Jones they want? I think it's possible that it's critic proof. It didn't do well with the critics, really. It's in the 50s on Metacritic.
Right.
So that's not good but it's not a critic's picture. That's not what it's supposed to be. It's not what it's built to be.
It didn't do well. And certainly our review was quite negative, it wasn't completely eviscerated. You know,
there are a lot of supporters of it. I know Slate likes it a lot. Bilge Elbery likes it a lot, you know.
Yeah, there was a good piece in The Ringer about it this week. There's a lot of people who are saying, you know, yeah, it's pretty silly, but I enjoyed XYZ. And most people are saying they really like Harrison Ford in it. And he's been doing a good job. I mean, talk about an actor promoting their work.
He has been promoting it all over the place. And I'm happy. It's so unusual to see him sort of gamely go. Oh, what I was going to say before is that one of the reasons the box office is down is that the talk shows are out because of the strike. That was the segue I was making.
Right. So you can't have Harrison Ford on Colbert having a viral moment or something like that.
He may have done it before the strike, actually, already.
But he's been in many places as he could be. But you can't have that. You can't do that for Barbie.
You can't do it right now. And you can't do it for Oppenheimer and Barbie. And so that's a hit. That's, you know, people are doing the Conan O'Brien podcast instead, you know, or, you know, Howard Stern or, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. Right. Which can only go so far because those are pretty niche audience. I mean, Howard Stern has a lot of followers, but
he does.
He's big. Over the top.
He's big.
So if we were to get past all this stuff, we're also looking ahead to the fall festivals because we're now getting it. I mean, it's 4th of July weekend. We're like more than halfway through the summer, essentially. More, you know, August is not entirely a full month because Telluride starts and Venice starts before it's over. So we're already hearing about movies that are getting in. This week, we got the first like actual announcement, which was a TIFF announcement of Taika Waititi's Next School Wins, a movie we've been putting on like wish lists for festivals for like probably two
it
and a half years.
It started production in 2019. It was supposed to come out in 2019. It's been delayed by.
Well, it had Army Hammer in it. Let's not forget.
A lot of time. So he finally finished it. And it's a Searchlight movie. It's a wide audience crowd pleaser, which is why they put it in Toronto.
Right. So
that's what you do with a movie like that. They're not going anywhere else with it. Yeah.
No, but I mean, Taika makes crowd pleasers, and he had Jojo Rabbit there and did win an Oscar there. So as a result of that launch, in a way, won the People's Choice Award at TIFF. So, you know, maybe being a crowd pleaser going into TIFF is not necessarily a bad
situation. It can be a very good thing. It can be a good, but the Venice list, I mean, Netflix, it takes its movies to Venice. So we've got Maestro, you know, that could turn up there. Focus could take to Telluride. Alexander Payne's The Holdovers. That's a likely thing because he's a Telluride regular.
Oh, yeah.
So that could happen.
I've heard it's good.
I want to see Ethan Coen's debut. I saw the trailer, Drive Away Dads. It looks fantastic.
Solo debut. It is funny. It's like Solo. We got the Joel Solo. Now we get the Ethan Solo.
And maybe in Venice, we'll see Michael Mann's Ferrari, you know, with Adam Driver. Yep. That would seem a good
fit. Seems like a Venice one. Yeah. And then Netflix has also got The Killer, which is a David Fincher movie. And of course, Maestro, the Bradley Cooper, Leonard Bernstein biopic.
I said that. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. So
and then Pablo Larraín, your fave, El Conde, that's coming up as well.
Right. Which could be the Chilean Oscar submission. So we'll see how all of that starts to come together.
So it's a typical thing where, you know, Venice is going to get a certain amount, and then some people will go from Venice to Telluride. Some people will go from Venice to Toronto. Some people go from Venice to London. You know, it's all a question mark of how the schedules play out.
Yeah, how they break down, and that it's different.
And some people will wait for New York. There could be some world premieres in New York as well.
And then even some people are telling me, well, we might wait for Sundance. So not for an awards title necessarily, but there are some conversations going on about fall versus Sundance, which is an interesting kind of a challenge.
Interesting, yeah. Some of the Cannes titles are going to turn up everywhere, but I wonder. I suspect the Todd Haynes could be one of the ones that waits for New York.
Yeah, that's a New York Film Festival kind of relaunch. And then, you know, the Neon movie that won the Palme d'Or, Anatomy of a Fall, they're going to want to reintroduce that somewhere.
All of those films will come back in the fall season.
Yeah. So I guess watch this space on that front. But going back to the strike stuff, so we record on Thursdays, and on Friday at midnight is when
that's the deadline.
So what we don't know is, like, if somebody's listening to our podcast on Saturday and there's a strike going on, we're coming from another universe.
So be aware that we this was as we were speaking, but the Fran Drescher announcement was interesting. You know, she was speaking on behalf of the negotiating committee for SAG-AFTRA, and the message of that announcement to the membership was basically, hey, we're making real progress here. We're going to probably, you know, settle this thing, you know, and shortly, and be aware. And then there was this Meryl Streep, Jennifer Lawrence, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, 300 people signing this thing saying, don't go so fast. We're willing to strike.
We're worried.
There are big issues at stake, and we don't want you to rush through.
Can I just say the funniest thing was that was an open letter that a lot of actors were invited to sign, and Fran Drescher herself signed it. So she basically signed the letter to herself, which shows you how performative all this stuff gets. And it's really hard. The thing that's weird about where we're coming from now. So if a strike happens, I'm sure we'll learn a lot about what the stakes are. We don't really know everything that they're asking for. So it's hard to know.
Well, we know that the AI stuff is important to them in a different way from what it was for the directors.
And them in a much bigger way.
Many issues of identity and permission at stake, and I'm sure those are on the table. But the whole question of getting some kind of compensation. We have a story about this today on the site about audio and video tapes.
Yeah,
that people
so many residual questions.
Auditions.
That can really change the nature of the profession for the next generation. And it affects not only with the WGA, where a lot of people are saying this mostly affects people who are lower on the totem pole. This kind of stuff could affect very established talent too. So, but the question that comes out of this from a practical standpoint is, you know, we're talking about all these fancy movies going to festivals. If there's an actor's strike, those actors are not going to be able to, you know, walk red carpets or do any kind of promotion for the work. So that's a real challenge.
My guess is that despite this salvo from the 300 people who signed this open letter. I suspect that what's going to happen is they're going to extend the deadline.
Yes.
Past tomorrow. They're going to go through the weekend, whether they've settled it or not, and announce next week that they've made an accommodation. But first, the membership has to ratify it.
Yeah.
So do those 300 people represent the full membership who have to vote on whatever settlement they come up with?
Yeah. I mean, given that it was a 97% voted for strike authorization, you get the sense that there are some really strong feelings about what's on the line here. So again,
giving an authorization is one thing. Voting yourself out of work for months is another, but many of them are unemployed most of the time.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's true. And this could lead to further unemployment if they don't get their terms right.
If there's a strike, it's a serious shutdown of our industry.
Right. Have stuff that's sort of limping along without writers because of the scripts are done or whatever. Now it's like everything, it's like COVID basically.
When the summer's over and the fall seasons start on TV, that's the real issue. It's not about film. There's a delay with film. It's television in the fall that's going to be impacted. All these shows are not going in front of cameras.
And then audiences really will start to notice, and then it'll start hurting bottom lines because you have people canceling subscriptions to things there's so many trickling down effects of this that will be really fascinating to follow if that does happen. But if they do reach some sort of agreement, whether it's this week or July, mid-July or whatever, it's also an interesting question. What does this mean for the WGA strike? Are they?
Oh, it helps them. If SAG strikes, this helps. This gives both of them leverage.
It validates them in a big way. But if they reach an agreement.
But if they reach an agreement, then the writers are out high and dry, and they're going to have to deal with giving up some of the things they want.
Yeah, because at that point, it's like they're the last holdouts and all the other kind of major stakeholders have said, we want to work and we figured out a way to make it happen. So that's
the writers' demand for guarantees on the number of people in writers' rooms. That is the thing that I never thought they would get. As much as I support their cause in many ways, that one may be a bridge too far.
Well, you're seeing, you know, these weird reactions in public from, like, you know, showrunner auteur types like Taylor Sheridan saying, like, you know, I'm the only one who writes my shows. I wouldn't have it any other way. And it's like not 100% true. He's just like not.
It isn't 100% true. It depends on the show. Some of them he does. Some of them he has help.
Right. He totally did. And he pissed a lot of people off. But that's sort of the perception that's making it hard. In some ways, it's like some of these people really don't. Like even the writers themselves who are like really established don't necessarily want more people forcibly added to their team. So there has to be some way of coming to terms with that. And it seems like a big business.
It's
request.
Something the showrunners, you know, get what they need up. They go up or they go down. We've talked about this, but that's going to be the real one of the dicey issues for the writers going forward, because after the actors decide what to do, then it's going to return to the writers to, you know, they're presumably negotiations will open up again.
Well, to be continued next week, one way or the other, we get a break because it's the 4th of July week. So we're going to take that as an excuse to put our pencils
down. Take a week off. We're going to take a week off. All right.
Yeah.
All
right. We're allowed. It is allowed in this business, and hopefully nothing crazy happens. What are you going to, get a chance to watch anything on 4th of July, or are you just going to turn the screens off?
So I have to finish The Bear. I've seen the first six episodes. It is so great. It is even better than last season. And the buzz on it is perfectly accurate. I would say that episode six features, the mother. It's a flashback episode played by Jamie Lee Curtis in a tour de force.
It's basically a movie. I mean, that was crazy.
It's extraordinary. There's a dinner scene. I mean, the whole thing is extraordinary, but just the alone. And John Bernthal is there, you know, as the older brother and everything. And Bob Odenkirk, who is hilarious.
Yeah, it's like borderline stunt casting, but it works pretty well because it's a self-contained thing in a way. And a lot of chaos too. So it won me over once I realized what I was watching, because I wasn't totally prepared for that. When you get through that, I highly recommend you check out For a Good Time, I'm a Virgo, Boots Riley's new show on Amazon Prime.
It's on my queue.
He's just such a fun, funky storyteller. It's like rough around the edges and kind of silly, but at the same time, it has real ideas, and it has a strike in its plot, so super timely, because he's a total socialist, this guy. And I love the idea that, you know, he's like a socialist with Amazon money making a movie about making a show about a strike. It's like there's so many layers to that they're worth unpacking, but it's a really good time. So that should keep you going once you finish The Bear, and we'll see each other on the other side.
Have a good week, enjoy your time off. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, and then we'll be in pure Barbie Oppenheimer mode for real. So I'll see you then.
All right. See you
take
later.
Take care, Ann. Bye. Bye-bye.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.